Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
My lab works on stem cells and cancer. For the stem cell work that we do, we focus on the bone marrow, where there are two important kinds of stem cells. There are hematopoietic stem cells and skeletal stem cells, both of which you need throughout your life. And we study the intrinsic mechanisms within stem cells that allow them to execute self-renewing divisions, as well as the extrinsic mechanisms by which the microenvironment in the bone marrow regulates stem cell function. And then we compare and contrast stem cell self-renewal with cancer cell replication. For today's purposes, I really want to focus on recently published data or unpublished data. And I'm going to tell you two kinds of stories, one about intrinsic mechanisms within stem cells that allow them to get activated, because most of the time hematopoietic stem cells are quiescent, and we know that that contributes to their ability to persist throughout life. And so I think it's one of the most interesting questions in the field of stem cell biology is how they get activated and how they tolerate activation, given that even activation of anabolic pathways tends to erode their self-renewal potential. And then secondly, some recent work about the microenvironment and implications of better understanding that environment for clinical transplantation. So I started or consult for a few biotech companies, but I'm not going to talk about anything related to the work that they do. All right, so in the interest of getting to recent data, this is a cartoon that'll give me an opportunity to summarize 20 years worth of work in which we identified the niche for hematopoietic stem cells. So we showed 20 years ago, literally, that hematopoietic stem cells reside immediately adjacent to sinusoidal blood vessels in the bone marrow and in the spleen. And sinusoids are a specialized form of vasculature that's only present in hematopoietic tissues. We went on to identify these leptin receptor positive cells, which are these stromal cells are by far the main source of growth factors for the maintenance of hematopoietic stem cells, as well as multiple other important growth factors for hematopoiesis in the bone marrow. And when we first identified these cells, we identified them based on their production of stem cell factor and CXCL12, which are two known niche factors that are necessary for hematopoietic stem cell maintenance. And we just assumed that as we started studying other aspects of the biology in the bone marrow, that we would come across other cell types. But we keep coming back to these cells over and over again, to the point now where we really think of them as the master regulators of the environment in the bone marrow. To a lesser extent than leptin receptor positive cells, endothelial cells also produce low levels of some growth factors that are functionally important for the maintenance of hematopoietic stem cells. And so that solidified the idea that there's a perivascular niche within the bone marrow. I should say, though, that they're not just maintaining hematopoietic stem cells. There are also many early restricted progenitors in the hematopoietic system, most of which depend on growth factors from leptin receptor positive cells. So in fact, there are the leptin receptor positive cells are a heterogeneous population. They all express niche factors, but different subsets are in different places, and we do see differences in gene expression among leptin receptor positive cells. And those differences contribute to their ability to create niches for different kinds of stem and progenitor cells in different perivascular locations throughout the bone marrow. So the leptin receptor positive cells also include the skeletal stem cells, or often called mesenchymal stem cells, in the bone marrow that give rise to all of the osteoblasts and adipocytes that arise in adult bone marrow. They regulate vascular regeneration. They sense and transduce mechanical forces into niche factor expression around arterioles, and they protect hematopoietic stem cells from inflammation. Okay, so that was 20 years worth of work. All right, what I want to talk about is nerves in the bone marrow. So Paul Fernet's laboratory drew our attention to the fact that there are known to be peripheral nerves within the bone marrow. And Daniel Lucas, when he was in Paul's lab, published an important paper in which they showed that the nerves are not necessary for normal steady state hematopoiesis, but they are necessary for the regeneration of the bone marrow after chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And in fact, nerves promote the regeneration of maybe every tissue in an evolutionarily conserved manner. So if you whack the arm off of a salamander and it grows back, it doesn't grow back without nerves. So it's a major question in biology why it is that and how it is that nerves promote tissue regeneration. And in the bone marrow, there was nothing known about which cells were interacting with the nerves, how bone marrow innervation was regulated, and we had limited insight into the mechanism by which the nerves promote regeneration. So Nerges Kara and Bo Shen took on this problem when they were in my laboratory. Nerges now works in biotech in Boston. Bo has started his own laboratory at the National Institute of Biological Sciences in Beijing. And a graduate student in Bo's lab, Zhang Gao, finished off this project. So knowing that neurotrophic factors are necessary for the maintenance of peripheral nerves, Nerges did single-cell RNA sequencing of the bone marrow and looked for neurotrophic factor expression. The only neurotrophic factor that we can see expressed inside the bone marrow is nerve growth factor, and 90% of it comes from the leptin receptor positive cells. So that suggested that it may be the leptin receptor positive cells themselves that are promoting the maintenance of peripheral nerves. And that I'm going to show you that turns out to be true. And that was completely different from any of the models that had been, speculative models that had been proposed previously. So we tested that by deleting nerve growth factor from the leptin receptor positive cells. And in these images, the red staining is sinusoidal blood vessels, and these green fibers are the peripheral nerves within the bone marrow. And you can see that if you delete nerve growth factor from the leptin receptor positive cells, there are no nerves in the bone marrow anymore. They grow in during development, but they're not maintained, and so they die back during adulthood. And consistent with what Daniel Lucas and Paul Fournette had published, if you, using this genetic approach, and we eliminated the peripheral nerves from the bone marrow, there was no effect on steady state hematopoiesis, but there was a massive deficit in the ability to regenerate the bone marrow after radiation or chemotherapy. So how is it that the nerves promote regeneration? One of the first things that Bo recognized is that there's a huge spike in nerve growth factor expression when the bone marrow is regenerating. So it takes about a month for the bone marrow to regenerate after irradiation. And at 2 weeks, that's peak regeneration when everything is dividing as fast as it can to try to regenerate blood vessels and stroma and hematopoietic cells. And you can see there's about a tenfold increase in the amount of nerve growth factor that's produced within the bone marrow 2 weeks after irradiation. So these photos are steady state bone marrow, where now the nerves are shown in red. And you can see that the nerves look pretty sparse under steady state conditions. But 2 weeks after irradiation, it looks like there's a lot more nerve fibers. And what we showed is that by increasing NGF expression, that promotes the sprouting of nerve fibers in the bone marrow. And so there's just a lot more nerves within the bone marrow. And we showed that that's necessary to promote regeneration because we think that the nerves are secreting, they're secreting catecholamines, actually, in what's called volume transmission. So it's not synaptically. They're just releasing catecholamines into the bone marrow. And we think that the increased density of nerve fibers during regeneration allows them to secrete catecholamines that have an influence in every part of the bone marrow rather than just some parts, as you might expect during steady state conditions. So how does this lead to regeneration? Well, here in green and in fuchsia, these are just two different genetic strategies to eliminate nerves from the bone marrow because all of these leptin receptor positive cells also express adiponectin, whereas the blue mice are the control mice that have nerves. So it's not just NGF that spikes during regeneration. We also see spikes in multiple other growth factors that are necessary for bone marrow regeneration. Stem cell factor is necessary for hematopoietic regeneration. Angiopoietin 2 is necessary for sinusoid regeneration. VEGF is necessary in general for vascular regeneration. But you can see that in the mice that don't have nerves in their bone marrow, we no longer see these spikes in stem cell factor or angiopoietin 2 or VEGF. And so the nerves are jacking up the production of multiple growth factors that are necessary for bone marrow regeneration. So how are they doing that? Well, some of the nerves in the bone marrow are sympathetic nerves. We know that they release catecholamines that activate beta adrenergic receptor signaling. And so we tested whether we could rescue the nerve loss phenotype by treating the mice with salbutamol, which is an agonist of beta adrenergic receptor. And so what this is showing you is that in the mice here in the green bar that have no nerves in their bone marrow, they're profoundly defective in their ability to regenerate early hematopoietic progenitors or hematopoietic stem cells as compared to the control mice in blue. But if we treat the mice with salbutamol, it completely rescues the nerve loss phenotype. And so this regeneration phenotype seems to be driven entirely by sympathetic nerves. There are three different beta adrenergic receptors. We deleted each of them, and we mated together all the combinations. And we know from doing that it's beta 2 and beta 3 that are the functionally important beta adrenergic receptors for bone marrow regeneration. Beta 1 doesn't matter at all. And that's going to be relevant in a few slides. So what cells are beta 2 and beta 3 acting in? This has been kind of a big issue in the field because there were a lot of proposals about nerve fibers maybe synapsing on this cell type or on another cell type that influenced the discussion about the identity of the niche. And we looked into our single cell RNA sequencing data, and surprise, surprise, beta 2 and beta 3 are mainly expressed by the leptin receptor positive cells themselves. And so we deleted beta 2 and beta 3 from the leptin receptor positive cells, and that was sufficient to completely phenocopy the nerve loss phenotype. That is, under steady state conditions, the loss of beta 2 and beta 3 from the leptin receptor positive cells has no effect on hematopoiesis at all. But during regeneration, if you don't have beta 2 and beta 3 in the leptin receptor positive cells, you have a profound defect in the ability to regenerate early hematopoietic progenitors as well as hematopoietic stem cells. So just to kind of connect the dots here, deleting beta 2 and beta 3 from the leptin receptor positive cells is sufficient to block these increases in growth factor expression during bone marrow regeneration. So what I've told you so far is that there's a reciprocal relationship between peripheral nerves in the bone marrow and leptin receptor positive cells, where the leptin receptor positive cells are producing the nerve growth factor that's necessary to maintain the nerves. And in return, the nerves are secreting catecholamines that activate beta adrenergic receptor signaling in the leptin receptor positive cells. And that's necessary during bone marrow regeneration to increase the production of multiple growth factors that are necessary for hematopoietic and vascular regeneration. Okay, so here's where it gets cool. If beta adrenergic receptor signaling is so important in leptin receptor positive cells, then what happens in people that happen to be on a beta blocker when they get a bone marrow transplant? There are lots and lots of people who take beta blockers for lots of different reasons. And so once in a while, there are people on the bone marrow transplant service who are on beta blockers. Now remember, I told you that beta 2 and beta 3 are the important ones for bone marrow regeneration. Beta 1 doesn't matter. And so our prediction from the mice is that there's two classes of beta blockers. There are non-selective beta blockers, which inhibit signaling from all beta adrenergic receptors, including beta 2 and beta 3. Our prediction from these experiments is that humans on a non-selective beta blocker would have a problem in grafting after a bone marrow transplant, whereas people on beta 1 selective inhibitors should be fine. So we tested this first in mice. Jinsuke Nishino is a senior scientist in my lab, and he worked with Bo Shen to treat the mice with carvedilol, which is one of the most commonly used non-selective beta blocker. And it completely phenocopies the nerve loss phenotype. That is, Under steady state conditions, there's absolutely no effect of carvedilol on hematopoiesis in the bone marrow. Bone marrow cellularity is normal. Hematopoietic stem cell frequency is normal. Early hematopoietic progenitors are normal. But after irradiation or chemotherapy, if the mice are on carvedilol, they can't regenerate the bone marrow normally, and they have a profound defect in the ability to regenerate hematopoietic stem cells and early hematopoietic progenitors. The net result here is that 100% of the control mice who were not getting carvedilol survive the transplant, whereas almost half of the mice on carvedilol died because they just couldn't regenerate hematopoiesis fast enough. Okay, so is this just something weird that happens in mice, or does this happen in humans too? We worked with Stephen Chung and Ashwin Kishtagari. Steve is a medical oncologist at UT Southwestern who does a lot of hematopoietic cell transplants. Ashwin does the same at Vanderbilt. Wen Huo Hu is a statistician from St. Jude's who helped us to analyze the clinical data. And so basically what they and their teams did was they went through 10 years of clinical data at UT Southwestern and at Vanderbilt, comparing outcomes after a hematopoietic cell transplant in people who were either not on a beta blocker or people who were on a beta 1 selective inhibitor versus people on a non-selective beta blocker. So the mice correctly predicted everything that was going to happen in the humans. So at UT Southwestern, people who were on non-selective beta blockers after a hematopoietic cell transplant showed a significant 4-day delay in neutrophil engraftment and a remarkable 2-week delay in platelet engraftment. When people get a bone marrow transplant, of course, you've wiped out their endogenous blood-forming system, and they really are at risk of dying, particularly of an opportunistic infection. And so every single day matters in terms of time to neutrophil engraftment and time to platelet engraftment. So these are people who are in the ICU, and these are alarming delays in engraftment. Whereas people who were on beta 1 selective inhibitors, as predicted by the mice, there was no significant effect on neutrophil or platelet engraftment. Okay, so those were the data from UT Southwestern. What about at Vanderbilt? We saw the same thing among people that got allogeneic transplants, that meaning from one person to another at Vanderbilt. But the surprise was, at UT Southwestern, we could also see a significant delay in engraftment after an autologous transplant, although the magnitude of the effect was much lower than what we saw after an allogeneic transplant. At Vanderbilt, we really could see no effect of beta blockers after an autologous transplant. So we wondered why, and Bob Collins, who runs the bone marrow transplant service at UT Southwestern, said, well, the big difference between an auto and an allo transplant is that nowadays everyone gets post-transplant chemotherapy after an allogeneic transplant for graft versus host disease prophylaxis. So one of the bad things that can happen after an allogeneic transplant is graft versus host disease, where T cells in the graft attack the recipient. And so in recent years, people figured out that you could control that by giving chemotherapy after the transplant to kill the activated T cells. And this works really well to prevent graft versus host disease. But what Bob was saying is maybe essentially what's happening when you give post-transplant chemotherapy for prophylaxis, it's a second round of damage to the niche. You damage the niche before you did the transplant, and then you damage it again after you do the transplant. And maybe it's under those circumstances that the leptin receptor positive cells need to be firing on all cylinders, and they need beta adrenergic receptor signaling in order to regenerate the bone marrow in time. And so we tested this first in mice. And the data in mice are consistent with Bob's idea. So when we treated with cyclophosphamide alone, this is one of the chemotherapy drugs that's used for graft versus host disease prophylaxis, there was no significant effect on survival or on engraftment, consistent with a lot of other work that was done by other people that led up to the use of that therapy. Consistent with what I've told you, carvedilol is bad. More than half of the mice died in an allogeneic transplant if you they just got carvedilol. And carvedilol synergized with cyclophosphamide so that cyclophosphamide alone didn't delay engraftment or kill mice, but the combination of carvedilol and cyclophosphamide killed mice and delayed engraftment to a greater extent than carvedilol alone. So what about in humans? Well, at UT Southwestern, everybody gets post-transplant chemotherapy if they got an allogeneic transplant. But at Vanderbilt, half the people do and half the people don't. So we divided the patient data up into, on the left, the people that didn't get post-transplant chemotherapy, and on the right, people that did, and then looked within those cohorts at the effects of beta-1 selective inhibitors and non-selective beta blockers. And what these data are showing is that if you didn't get post-transplant chemotherapy, there was no significant effect of either beta-1 selective inhibitors or non-selective beta blockers on time to engraftment. Whereas if you did get post-transplant chemotherapy, there was no significant effect of beta-1 selective inhibitors, but now we see a massive 26-day delay in platelet engraftment in people that receive non-selective beta blockers. This is a multivariate analysis that's designed to assess whether or not beta blockers are an independent variable, and the data suggests that they are. And moreover, these are all the other variables that can influence time to engraftment. The only other variable that had a similar magnitude of effect as compared to non-selective beta blockers was a mismatch from the donor between the donor and the recipient. And that's to be avoided at all costs clinically. So it just illustrates how big of an effect this is. So as you would imagine, this has an effect on survival. People at UT Southwestern that happened to be a non-selective beta blocker were much less likely to survive an allogeneic transplant as compared to people who were not on a beta blocker. And data that I'm not going to take the time to show you, we can overcome the effect of beta blockers by transplanting higher doses of hematopoietic stem cells. This makes sense because in the end, you're depending on the niche to promote engraftment, and the niche doesn't have to work as hard if you transplant higher doses of hematopoietic stem cells. So we've showed that experimentally in mice. And in the human data, if we broke out the people that got unusually large doses of stem cells, we no longer saw the effect of beta blockers. And so the people who are at risk are people that get allogeneic transplants with kind of standard doses of hematopoietic stem cells and post-transplant chemotherapy. And our data suggests that people who fall in that category should either discontinue beta blockers before their transplant. You just have to wait 3 weeks and then you can start them again. Or if they can't tolerate discontinuing beta blockers, transition them onto a beta-1 selective inhibitor before the transplant and then for at least until they engraft. And I should say at UT Southwestern, this has already changed clinical practice. They're already doing this. The first thing that happens if people come in on a non-selective beta blocker needing a hematopoietic cell transplant is they get moved onto a beta-1 selective inhibitor before the transplant is done. There are multiple additional, we're working with multiple additional institutions now trying to analyze more cohorts of data. Part of why that's interesting is that every institution does their transplants a little bit differently. And we learned a lot by comparing the data from UT Southwestern and Vanderbilt. And so there could be additional risk factors that we'll uncover. And we may be able to better define which patients are most sensitive to these effects. But in those patients, our data suggests that this makes a difference between survival and not survival. OK, so so far, I've told you a lot about the niche. And said that you know it creates a niche for hematopoietic stem cells as well as a number of early restricted progenitors. But there's been two kind of open questions in this area. One is, are the leptin receptor positive cells only regulating stem cells in progenitors, or could they also be regulating terminal differentiation in the bone marrow? And secondly, there's been a lot of speculation that in addition to producing growth factors, that the leptin receptor positive cells may be able to non-cell autonomously regulate metabolism in the cells that fall within the niches that they regulate. And so I'm going to address those questions in this unpublished story. Yuan Yuan Xue is a postdoc in my lab. I call her YY because it's easier to say. She was going through our single cell RNA sequencing data and noticed that there's a chemokine called CXCL14 that is only expressed in leptin receptor positive cells within the bone marrow. These are two different subsets of leptin receptor positive cells, both of which create niches for stem cells and early hematopoietic progenitors. This chemokine is known to regulate, promote the migration of inflammatory cells into sites of inflammation, like, you know, if you have an injury, CXCL14 recruits inflammatory cells from the blood. But to my knowledge, it was not known to play any role in the regulation of hematopoiesis. YY made a DSRED reporter allele to confirm the expression pattern and essentially saw what was predicted from the single cell RNA sequencing. These little circles that you see in the bone marrow, these are the sinusoids. And you can see that there are green leptin receptor positive cells around the sinusoids, and some of those leptin receptor positive cells are also positive for CXCL14. They're the yellow ones. It looks from this image like it's about half of the leptin receptor positive cells that make CXCL14, so it's not all of them. But if we look by flow cytometry instead, by flow cytometry, we can detect low levels of CXCL14 that we don't pick up by eye. And flow cytometry says it's more like 90% of the leptin receptor positive cells that make CXCL14. So is CXCL14 expression in the bone marrow functionally important? Well, looking at blood cell counts, if we knock out CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells, no effect on white blood cell counts, no effect on red blood cell counts, but we see a significant decline in platelet counts, and the magnitude of the decline increases with age. Platelet counts are very highly regulated in our blood, so this is a big effect, and it's a big enough effect that if we bleed these mice, they don't clot normally. If we eliminate platelets from the blood and let them regenerate, in the absence of CXCL14, they regenerate more slowly. Okay, so why are the platelet counts down? Well, this is the lineage that gives rise to platelets. Hematopoietic stem cells give rise to early megakaryocyte progenitors, which give rise to late megakaryocyte progenitors. They mature into big megakaryocytes that further mature into what are called proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes. These proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes have long processes that they insert into sinusoids, and it's through those processes that they dump platelets into circulation. So we looked at hematopoiesis in the bone marrow, and in the absence of CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells, bone marrow cellularity is normal, stem cell frequency and function are normal, multipotent progenitors are normal. Basically, every hematopoietic progenitor looked normal in the bone marrow, including megakaryocyte lineage progenitors. But when you get to the end of this lineage, you can't assay this by flow cytometry anymore because mature megakaryocytes are giant cells that just don't make it through a flow cytometer, and same with proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes. So to analyze the later stages of thrombopoiesis, we had to cut sections through the bone marrow, and we noticed that with no CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells, the megakaryocytes were smaller. And that was the first clue that the megakaryocytes weren't maturing normally. And then when we started counting proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes in the bone marrow, they were profoundly depleted. Most of the proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes that you would expect to find were gone if we eliminated CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells. So how is it that CXCL14 promotes megakaryocyte maturation into proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes? Well, we did gene expression profiling on megakaryocytes from the wild type versus mice in which we deleted CXCL14 from leptin receptor positive cells. And when we looked at molecular function GO terms, the number one GO term on the list was lipid binding. And so we made a list of all of the genes in that gene set that significantly differed between the CXCL14 mutant and the wild-type mice. And you can see that almost all of these genes are going down when we delete CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells. There's a couple that went up, but the vast majority of them go down. As we explored this in more detail, we realized that if we deleted CXCL14 from the leptin receptor positive cells, there was a profound reduction in the levels of PPAR gamma. So PPAR gamma is a master regulator of lipid metabolism. And part of the way it promotes lipid metabolism is by promoting the expression of multiple fatty acid transporters. And so most of those fatty acid transporters that are transcriptional targets of PPAR gamma also decline in expression. FABP5, FATP4, CD36, they're all going down in the absence of CXCL14. So this suggested that maybe the problem here is that the megakaryocytes just can't take up enough fatty acids. And others have shown that that in order for megakaryocytes to mature into proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes and to produce platelets, they consume a lot of lipids. Because when you're pumping these platelets out into circulation, they're membrane-bound, and so you're giving up a lot of lipids. So there needs to be remodeling of lipid metabolism. And basically what I'm telling you here is that CXCL14 is necessary to remodel lipid metabolism for megakaryocyte maturation. So to test whether or not lipids were really depleted from the mutant megakaryocytes, we did a lipidomic analysis on megakaryocytes from the CXCL14 mutant versus control mice. These are all of the lipids that changed. There were a couple that went up, but you can see the vast majority of lipids were depleted. And the other thing you'll notice is that these triglycerides, most of them contain polyunsaturated fatty acids. Saturated and monounsaturated fatty acids, cells can make on their own. Polyunsaturated fatty acids, we have to get from our diet. We can't make them. We think what's happening is all types of fatty acids are being depleted, but the cells are able to compensate for the loss of saturated and monounsaturated fatty acids. But they're not able to compensate for the loss of polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are significantly depleted in the megakaryocytes. So we decided, if this is really what's causing the failure of platelet production, then could we rescue this phenotype by feeding the mice a high-fat diet? And this high-fat diet 1, in particular, is high in polyunsaturated fatty acids. And so what these data are showing is that mice on normal chow show this depletion of platelets, but mice on the high-fat diet don't show the depletion of platelets. The effect is even more clear when you look at proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes, which are greatly depleted in the mice in normal chow, but are not depleted in the mice on the high-fat diets. And always the diet with high polyunsaturated fatty acids gave us the best rescues. So conceptually, the reason this is interesting is it shows that the leptin receptor positive cells are not just regulating the maintenance of stem cells in progenitors. They're also regulating the terminal differentiation of at least some kinds of hematopoietic cells. In megakaryocytes, they do this by promoting the maturation of megakaryocytes into proplatelet-forming megakaryocytes and the formation of platelets. They do it by reprogramming lipid metabolism in megakaryocytes in a way that allows them to increase fatty acid uptake. And so there's, again, been speculation for years that the leptin receptor positive cells may be able to regulate the metabolic state of cells in their niches. That turns out to be true, but I think this is the first evidence for that. Okay, so let me just tell you one last story. This is a story about how hematopoietic stem cells get activated after hematopoietic stresses. Pregnancy is a hematopoietic stress because you get bigger when you're pregnant, and so you gotta make red blood cells fast. Red blood cells are a substantial fraction of the blood volume. So if your blood volume goes up, you gotta make red blood cells or you're gonna become anemic. Daisuke Nakata, who's now a professor at Baylor University, when he was in my lab, he published a paper showing that hematopoietic stem cells and erythroid progenitors expand in number during pregnancy in a manner that's driven at least partly by estrogen. Estrogen goes up during pregnancy. It puts the stem cells on alert. If you get pregnant, estrogen stays high. It activates hematopoietic stem cells and mobilizes them to the spleen. And in the spleen, they start producing red blood cells. That's all necessary for a mouse to avoid becoming anemic. But we knew that estrogen wasn't the whole story. And so Julia Fan, who was an MD PhD student in my lab, decided to try to further develop this story and better understand the underlying mechanisms. She compared the gene expression profiles of hematopoietic stem cells from pregnant and non-pregnant mice. Now, we had done this before, and we didn't really come up with much. And so when Julia did it, instead of doing what almost everybody does, which is to discard repetitive sequences to focus in on protein-coding genes, she didn't discard the repetitive sequences, just looked at everything that came out of whole RNA sequencing. And what she found was that 5 out of the top 7 gene sets that were upregulated in the stem cells during pregnancy were retrotransposons, multiple different families of retrotransposons. So it was sort of counterintuitive because, gee, I'm not sure you'd want to turn on retrotransposons in your stem cells during pregnancy, but this is what the data was telling us. And you know, the data, it's 5 out of the top 7 gene sets. So we wondered whether or not the retrotransposon derepression during pregnancy in the stem cells was contributing to the increase in red blood cell production. So how could that occur? Well, when retrotransposons are transcribed, there's a subset of retrotransposons that encode reverse transcriptase. And reverse transcription leads to the formation of DNA-RNA hybrids or double-stranded DNA that activate innate immune sensors within cells, like cGAS and STING. And when we looked at the types of retrotransposons that were coming on, the young retrotransposons that still have active reverse transcriptase were actually enriched. So that was encouraging for us to think that this is not just some random thing. They might be doing something. So the way we tested that is by treating pregnant and non-pregnant mice with reverse transcriptase inhibitors. The same reverse transcriptase inhibitors that people take to suppress HIV replication also inhibit the reverse transcriptase enzyme encoded in retrotransposons. And so that's not going to shut the retrotransposon off, but the prediction is that it should reduce the activation of innate immune pathways because it would prevent the production of DNA-RNA hybrids and double-stranded DNAs. And so when we treated non-pregnant mice with reverse transcriptase inhibitors, there was absolutely no effect on hematopoiesis, as you would expect. But when we treated pregnant mice, now you see a huge expansion in the numbers of hematopoietic stem cells in the spleen of mice during pregnancy, and most of that effect was blocked if we gave the mice reverse transcriptase inhibitors. Similarly, you see a huge expansion in erythroid progenitors in the spleen during pregnancy. Part of that effect was blocked by reverse transcriptase inhibitors. The net effect is that reverse transcriptase inhibitors had no effect on red blood cell counts in non-pregnant mice, but pregnant mice became anemic on reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So this was encouraging for us to think that retrotransposons are promoting the expansion in erythropoiesis by activating innate immune sensors. So the next question was obviously whether cGAS and STING are necessary for the increase in hematopoietic stem cells and erythropoiesis. So STING deficiency has absolutely no effect on hematopoiesis in non-pregnant mice. But in pregnant mice, it blocks the expansion of hematopoietic stem cells in the spleen. It partly blocks the increase in early erythroid progenitors in the spleen of pregnant mice. It partly blocks the expansion of late erythroid progenitors in the spleen of pregnant mice. And again, like we had seen with reverse transcriptase inhibitors, STING deficiency has no effect on red blood cell counts in normal non-pregnant mice, but all the pregnant mice became anemic if they lacked STING. We see the exact same phenotype when we knocked out cGAS. So it really the data said that retrotransposons are activating cGAS STING. So how did cGAS STING promote red blood cell production? Well, it's known that cGAS STING signaling induces interferon expression, and it's known that interferons can activate hematopoietic stem cells. So we looked at interferon expression, and sure enough, during pregnancy, we see a big increase in interferon production, specifically within hematopoietic stem cells. We looked in a lot of other hematopoietic cell populations. We think it's probably not, the interferons are probably not only coming on in the hematopoietic stem cells because we can see increased systemic levels of interferon, but it's not, this is not a broad effect on lots of hematopoietic cells because so far we've not been able to find any other hematopoietic cells that are turning on interferon during pregnancy. And if we look in STING-deficient mice, now we can't see interferon coming on anywhere. And so cGAS and STING really are turning on interferons in the hematopoietic stem cells. And we can see interferon response genes turning on. So, but this is a very highly tailored effect that's only happening in the subset of hematopoietic stem cells that get mobilized from the bone marrow to the spleen and that engage in erythropoiesis in the spleen. The subset of hematopoietic stem cells that stays behind in the bone marrow, they don't turn on retrotransposons. So the way that we know that is here we're looking at interferon-regulated gene expression, and we're not seeing interferon-regulated genes coming on in the stem cells that stay behind in the bone marrow of pregnant mice. We see a modest interferon response in the whole bone marrow, we think because there is systemic increase in interferon levels. But where we're really seeing the interferon response is in the hematopoietic stem cells that get mobilized to the spleen of pregnant mice. And if we do this analysis in STING-deficient mice, now most of that interferon response goes away. Okay. So again, the question is this just some weird thing that mice do, or do humans also allow their retrotransposons to come on during pregnancy? Aslan Tazdagan is a former postdoc in my lab who now has his own laboratory in Essen in Germany. He got blood samples from pregnant women and non-pregnant women, and we isolated hematopoietic stem cells from the blood and did gene expression profiling, and it's the same as we saw in mice. Two of the top three gene sets that are enriched in human hematopoietic stem cells during pregnancy are retrotransposons, and they are the two families of retrotransposons that still have the ability to retrotranspose because the line elements express reverse transcriptase. Number two on the list are the interferon-regulated genes that we saw coming up in mouse hematopoietic stem cells. Now, one curious thing that we still don't understand because we have still limited access to the medical records, we saw this effect in most of the human samples that we sequenced, but not in all. For about two-thirds of women, we could see retrotransposons coming on in their stem cells, and we could see interferon responses, but in one-third of women, we couldn't see it. So we don't know what's happening in that one-third of women, but it was experimentally useful because when we broke people down based on whether they de-repressed retrotransposons or did not, we could see the changes in interferon-regulated genes were happening in the people that turned on retrotransposons and not so much in the people that didn't turn on retrotransposons. And one of the beautiful things of these experiments is that Aslan was able to get blood from women who, with well-controlled HIV, who had been long-term on reverse transcriptase inhibitors and who are now pregnant. And if they were on reverse transcriptase inhibitors, like what we saw in mice, it dramatically attenuated the interferon response that we were seeing in people, in most women that weren't on reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So the data looked the same in humans as compared to mice. And then this is the last piece of data that I'm going to show you. We also looked at the effect on blood cell counts because remember what we had seen in mice was that normal mice who weren't pregnant, normal hematopoiesis on reverse transcriptase inhibitors. But once the mice got pregnant, if they were on a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, they became anemic. So what these data are showing is that whether people are pregnant or not, whether they're on a reverse transcriptase inhibitor or not, there's no effect on white blood cell counts. And here, we're always looking at the same person where we were able to get data on blood cell counts before they became pregnant and then again after they became pregnant. And so these connected circles, this is the same woman prior to pregnancy and during pregnancy. So anyway, if you look across all the samples, there's no significant effect of pregnancy or reverse transcriptase inhibitors on white blood cell counts or platelet counts. But if you look at hemoglobin levels in people who were not on reverse transcriptase inhibitors, there is no significant change in hemoglobin levels. So some people, it goes down. Some people, it goes up. On average, no significant change. But among people that were on reverse transcriptase inhibitors, every single one of them became anemic during pregnancy. And we think because of the mechanisms that we had worked out in mice. And so what I've shown you is that pregnancy, during pregnancy, retrotransposons are derepressed in hematopoietic stem cells. This leads to cGAS sting activation, interferon production, changes in interferon-regulated genes, increased hematopoietic stem cell numbers and erythropoiesis, mobilization to the spleen. And this is necessary to avoid anemia both in mice and in humans. And so part of the reason why we have an inactivated retrotransposons in our genome is that we need them. We've co-opted them to activate hematopoiesis during pregnancy to avoid maternal anemia. So now one of the big questions is this just something that happens during pregnancy, or is this more generalizable? The only context where we've looked so far is that we've tried serial bleeding in mice, and we see the same thing. The same retrotransposons get derepressed, and it contributes to the recovery of the hematopoietic system. But it's an open question as to whether for other kinds of hematopoietic injuries like chemotherapy, would these mechanisms be at play? Would there be no retrotransposon expression? Would there be some kind of a different set of mechanisms? So that's one of the things that we're testing now. And the other big question is this just a hematopoietic stem cell thing? Or are we going to see this across stem cells from multiple different tissues? My bias is that this is going to be more generalizable, and that there's going to be stem cells from multiple tissues that depend on the derepression of retrotransposons in order to activate and to repair tissue injury. I tried to acknowledge the people as I went through, so I'll just stop here and take questions. Thanks.
Beautiful work. I'm curious about your leptin receptor positive studies and the CXCL14. Did you look at other lineages or just the megakaryocyte platelet forming lineage?
We looked at everything, and we really only see defects in the later stages of megakaryocyte maturation. And so it illustrates the range of mechanisms that these leptin receptor positive cells have for regulating diverse aspects of hematopoiesis.
I liked your retrotransposon talk, right? I'm thinking because, you know, when they are transcribed, they also form double-stranded RNA. And dsRNA is also recognized by PKR, an enzyme, right? I mean, an RNA binding protein. And then PKR also ends up affecting interferon response. So I'm wondering if aside from the more popular DNA side of things, if there are also dsRNA responses?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And that's one of the next things that we want to work on. We think it's probably not just cGAS sting. We think there's probably multiple of these immune sensors that get activated. You'll notice that in some of the data that I showed you, it looks like, you know, a sort of a small rescue of the effects. And we think that's because there's probably multiple of these pathways that are being activated in parallel. And so what we need to do is just get knockout mice. People have examined a lot of these knockout mice and shown that there was no hematopoietic phenotype under steady state conditions. Now the question is, which ones of them would have a phenotype during pregnancy?
Thanks, Sean. Great talk. Couple questions. First, on the CXCL14s, story. I'm curious if the reduction in the fatty acid uptake is due to a receptor downregulation, how is it that high-fat diet is sort of sufficient to rescue that if the defect is from import? And
well, it's not that they don't have any receptors. What we think is happening is that, you know, if you have lower levels of fatty acid transporters, and if you have a dramatic increase in the amount of fatty acid in the environment, that you can still take up enough. They just become limiting if there's not much fatty acid in the environment. And regular mouse chow that we give has quite low levels of fat in it.
So were you surprised then that the high-fat diet didn't have any effect in the wild-type mice on platelet production?
I don't know that it would be fair to say that it had no effect. We could see effects of the high-fat diet on hematopoiesis, not necessarily in the parameters that I show, but it wasn't that it didn't have any effect.
And then quickly, do people that live at higher altitude have more retrotransposon activation?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't know the answer. The two stresses where we've seen this effect, bleeding and pregnancy, they're both erythropoietic stresses. The hematopoietic system ramps up the production of red blood cells, but not white blood cells. There are other kinds of stresses that ramp up production of white and red blood cells, like chemotherapy, for example. And so there really is a rationale for why what I talked about could be a specific response to an erythropoietic stress, and that would be another example of one.
So when you just mobilize HSCs to the spleen, you don't see the activation of that signaling?
If you just mobilize stem cells to the spleen, you see some derepression of retrotransposons, but not of the magnitude that we see during pregnancy.
Okay, I have two questions. Maybe I'll start with the retrotransposon because that was kind of towards the end. So maybe it was my kind of thoughts around it, but we know that pregnancy is also inducing HSC expansion and production of differentiated cells. So given that about 40% of our genome is composed of those retrosposome, would you think or suggest that it's also affecting in a way our HSC expansion during pregnancy or only the differentiation of those?
No, it's also contributing to the expansion because much of that expansion is occurring in the spleen.
I see. Okay. And so the first question that I had actually relevant more to the nerve system that you showed in the bone marrow, which is in many ways surprising that during steady state had no effect on hematopoiesis. But generally, if I'm thinking about HSC, they will be very important during bleeding, as you mentioned, and pregnancy clearly, as we see. What about other stress factors that nerves for me will be responsive and act upon other than just steady state that you would say, okay, there's no effect?
I think that nerves in the bone marrow are probably broadly necessary to regenerate the bone marrow after a wide range of stresses. We've tried irradiation and chemotherapy, and it probably doesn't matter what kind of chemotherapy you use. So I suspect all types of regeneration depend on nerves.
Okay, so we have one question from the Zoom. 6CL14 is expressed by many tissues and other stem cells. Do you think lipid metabolism and adaptations can be regulated similarly in other types of skeleton stem cells?
Yeah, that's a really good question of whether or not part of the way that CXCL14 is regulating, for example, the migration of inflammatory cells to sites of tissue damage, whether that might also be influenced by effects on lipid metabolism. It's not something that we've tested, but it's a good question.
So I think we'll thank Sean Morrison for amazing and inspiring talk, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, everybody.